Hello, this is John Alsop, and it's your Internet Marketing 5 a Day. If you didn't get your yesterday's, then there was a bit of a glitch. A technical glitch, which I've now overcome valiantly. Okay, the first thing, apologies for that. The first thing is an article in Saturday's Guardian about being able to jump queues for money. The book being touted is What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets by Michael Sandel. It's kind of all stuff that I know about, but and it's editorialized. But it highlights a bigger point. And there's just one example in the article, which is kids, I can't find it now. I'm going to find it. Here we go. No, can't find it. Anyway, if you add a financial incentive, for instance, for kids to read, then it doesn't make them read more beyond the remit of the cash incentive. And Caldini's influence kind of covers this point. If you can get someone to read without the financial incentive, if you can just get them to read a sentence or to read, you know, the very first book, or to listen to a book, or whatever's easiest, whatever kind of works to get them started, then they kind of, the way your mind works is you make a reason why you're doing it. So, you know, if you're in school, the only reason you're reading is because you're in school. You're forced to. So that doesn't make you a reader. But incidentally, you might find that you quite enjoy it. And that would be a reason that you would take home, and you would live your life with this reason that you enjoy reading. And so when an opportunity arose, you might read something. But if, so outside of school, if you have someone who you want to read and you pay them money, what you're saying is, do things for money. And the only reason they need, the overt reason and the massive reason that's obvious in there is you can be bought, and the reason you're doing this is because you're getting paid to do it. And so when the payment stops, there's no reason to carry on reading. If you can get some reason that isn't financial, don't have the financial reason. If you if there's another reason for them to read, let's say they enjoy it, or let's say they're interested in dinosaurs, or they're interested in history, or celebrity, or music, and they can read something, that's a reason for them to read, because they're interested in these other subjects. Or even if it's gaming, you know, their favourite game might be set in, whatever the driving and shooting type game is. I don't play games, so I have no idea. Then there must be the biography of a Hollywood stunt driver. So there's a reason to read. And once they're reading, then other reasons will appear. So that they enjoy it, or that it's relaxing, or that it is a free or cheap way of passing the time, or that it's something useful to do while they're traveling, those kinds of things. Or it's a way to get to sleep at night. All of those other reasons are reasons to read. And they start to add up. And then you start to have a lifetime habit. And it's about consistency. Once you've got them to read for the first reason, then they start to think, well, now I'm reading, why am I reading? And the other reasons kind of appear. So the issue here is that financial incentives kind of ruin a lot of things. And this is coming up in all sorts of things that I'm reading at the moment. And it kind of talks to the society that we're in as well. That having a financial inducement removes morality. And suddenly people are not doing things for the right reasons. They're doing things because of finance, because they're being paid to do it. And that is possibly infiltrating, for instance, professionalism, where you have a profession that has very high moral standing, makes decisions on a professional basis, and that's the whole kind of basis of their life. And then you add in financial incentives, and psychology says that kind of ruins everything. So we really have to watch that business of financial incentives and think about what. I mean, back to marketing. I used to do the publicity for MapInfo, which was an American mapping company, and their habit was that there was always an offer. You know, maybe 3 weeks would go by before the next offer. And they used it to sell their software. So you would get, you know, the software itself plus a data bundle, let's say. Excuse me, noises, it's the cat. So, you know, you could get the basic software plus a UK data bundle, let's say. For a special offer price, and then the next month it'd be something else. And it seemed to me that they only ever sold when there was an offer. That seemed like that didn't seem right from a marketing point of view to me. But you know, maybe they were wiser than I am. But you start to get people who buy just because the price is low, and I don't think that that's right, because then you've got people who bought it because it was cheap, not because of any loyalty to the product being the best product, not because they've made that decision. They just bought it because it was an offer. So I think there's all kinds of problems with special offers there. Okay, so stopping banging on about that. So the next thing is a viral video for Tippex. The Hunter and the Bear seems to have been something that everybody talked about. I didn't notice it the first time around. This is a follow-up video, and it's interactive in as much as you, I mean, it's very good in the way that it takes over the YouTube interface and kind of spreads out into it. That's innovative. But you know, for such a video, it didn't work on my mobile, which is a fairly up-to-date Android, Galaxy S2. So, there you are, usability. Yeah, it's all, and fine, they had 8 million views or whatever. So it just raises all kinds of questions for me. You know, who's going to argue against 8 million views? But it didn't work on my phone. That's crazy. And raising awareness for Tippex? Are we really? Isn't Tippex dead? It just seems all a bit weird. So, anyway, see what you think. That's what's going on in the world of American marketing. Next up was this idea, or the kind of sales page where you have mainly a video, perhaps. Very little text, but probably not, barring the call to action. So basically, you have a page where the only thing that someone can do is buy from you or leave. Nothing else. And I just read, coincidentally, I was talking about that and whether it was a good thing and whether it worked for me or not. And then I just came across somebody who said he got a 38% conversion with one. So that's pretty high. Next thing was just a thought, just thinking about brand icons and what can be recognisable about your brand. And it's not just the logo. One of the things that could be your brand's, your brand is your building. So we have things like the GPO Tower, as was, and the Hoover Building, Battersea Power Station, those kinds of iconic buildings that could be tied to, you know, to a company. The final thing is, we had ME/CFS Awareness Day a few days ago. And my inbox filled, because my partner has ME/CFS, so my inbox filled with essentially awareness building stuff about how drab and dreary life is with ME/CFS. And it kind of got me down a little, because I'm thinking, well, you know, we're in a pretty depressing time at the moment. Do I really want to read about how much more depressed somebody else is? It didn't seem, from a marketing point of view, very motivating. You'll have seen, or maybe it's a Guardian thing, but there's been a long-running ad in the Guardian about homelessness, and it's positive. You get a small ad at the start of the paper somewhere in a place that isn't, that you're not likely to notice, and then later on in the paper you get a full page ad which says, did you notice Derek? You know, that was the ad before. Not many people do, but we gave Derek a warm place and now he's in education, that, you know, that kind of story. And you can help get more Derek's off the street. And that seems a more positive kind of approach. The problem is there isn't that much that's positive on the ME/CFS front, but I wrote a blog that talked about some of the positives of it. You know, at least we don't live in Homs, and at least, you know, I mean, there's some seriously grim illnesses that you could get. And yes, ME/CFS does take a lot, you know, but you're not in constant pain, you're not, so. But anyway, the issue is how to market and fundraise for illnesses. And we've had a recent disaster in ME/CFS where an American research place came out with, we found the cure. And we're going to call it XMRV. And the studies in the end didn't get replicated. And there are all kinds of possible reasons for that. I hope that it's because of the reasons that they gave. But then that research centre's kind of imploded into all kinds of problems with staff and legal problems as well, and reputational problems. So where the ME/CFS community raised money for that centre, now many feel kind of ripped off or let down. And so there's another campaign now to open a research centre in the UK. But there are all these other feelings about why are we raising money for a research centre when that's what universities do? They make money from research, so presumably if they come up with a cure, then they would make money from it. So why are we funding that? That should be fundable by the normal means. Lots and lots of questions around that. And that's because of my kind of personality, wanting to get it all organised in my head before I decide where to put some money. So I'm just kind of rattling around all that and working out what that means in terms of marketing and fundraising for illnesses. It's really quite kind of intricate. But if you have any thoughts on that, then yell. Okay, that's the internet marketing. 5 a day. We'll do this again, only better tomorrow. All right, talk to you later. Bye.